This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The country went through a really brutal civil war. So the legacy of democracy and development in institutions has just not been there. And I think this is another reason why ethno-federalism is really becoming a challenge to implement in Ethiopia.
That's David Monda, political science professor at City University in New York, on why ethnic-based federalism is not working in Ethiopia. Details coming up. Also, Nigeria and Cameroon work towards an accord on the border. And a French resident of Senegal goes viral with Wolof lessons. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The U.S. government's representative to the Minerals Security Partnership, an alliance of mostly Western countries that aims to speed the development of energy mineral supply chains, said last month that a Chinese company was using predatory tactics to hold down the price of cobalt mined in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Henry Wilkins looks at what this means for Africa.
Last month, Jose W. Fernandez, the U.S. government's representative to the Mineral Security Partnership, or MSP, an alliance of mostly Western countries set up in 2022, said a Chinese mining company, CMOC, was using predatory pricing to keep the cost of cobalt extracted from the Democratic Republic of Congo down. Businesses sometimes use the tactic, illegal in some countries, to muscle out competition and establish a monopoly. In a written response to VOA, CMOC said, "We firmly deny the accusations. This round of price fluctuation is within the normal range and is a true reflection of market supply and demand." The MSP says its aim is to eliminate predatory pricing and to reform the world's mining industry, where exploitation of workers and institutions in developing nations is common. Fernandez, who is also the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth, Energy and the Environment, says African minerals like cobalt are essential for the world's transition to green energy in the face of climate change.
We need Africa. We need African resources in order to do that. That's an opportunity for Africa, and Africa can demand what it's always wanted, which is technical assistance, knowledge transfer, working with communities, benefiting with communities.
Analysts say that the US, European Union, and other MSP countries are also aiming to steer control of strategic resources away from the People's Republic of China, as its rivalry with the West intensifies. Fernandez says this isn't the case.
The objective here is to diversify our supply chains. It is true that for the most part, the PRC controls many of these minerals. That's a vulnerability not only for the West, but for all of us, as we aim to do all of this while upholding high environmental, social, and governance values. And by that, I mean working with communities to make sure that communities benefit from their natural resources.
Mining experts told VOA that Chinese companies are carrying out some of the worst practices in the mining industry and that the MSP is important in offsetting that. Andre Bayer is CEO of Core Potash, a mining company operating in the Republic of Congo.
It's an important reaction to counteract those that do not have the same scruples. But what happens is you've got a lot of private Chinese investors in Africa, and who are no longer even being reined in by their government in their country, and their behavior. Actually, their behavior can be the most shocking.
One analyst says the MSP's task is difficult because it and Western countries do not have the same sway, control, or leverage that China has over its private companies. Christian Gerard Nima is with the China Global South Project.
So that's why, whether being the MSP, the IRA, or the Critical Raw Material Act in Europe, or any kind of initiative in Canada or in Australia, they are all depending on one thing. They're depending on the fact that private companies will be willing to follow through with the strategy.
Ultimately, Fernandez says African countries will have to decide for themselves whom to partner with. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
in 1991, when the Tigray People's Liberation Front took power after a successful armed struggle in Ethiopia, one of the core principles it instituted was an ethnic-based federalism. Since then, according to David Monda, political science professor at City University in New York, ethnic identity has become the basis of politics in Ethiopia. The way it is set up, Monda says, federal ethnic nations and nationalities in Ethiopia, such as the Amhara, Oromo, or Tigrayan, have a defined territorial homeland backed by the constitution to establish their own regions or, if they so desire, to seek independence.
As the problem in Ethiopia is that the ethnic federal nations in the Ethiopian context are not interested in governing these ethno-federal regions, whether it's Amharic or Tigrayan or Oromia, or even Somali in the Ogaden region. They are not interested in having these regions as part of a whole. They are very interested in separatism. So, for example, in Ethiopia, you have the Ogaden region, where that area wants to secede and become a part of Somalia. And the Oromia, who are the largest group in the country, want to secede and make their own country. So ethno-federalism works when the sub-national units are interested in governing as sub-national entities within a contiguous whole, meaning within a state.
Monda notes the drawbacks of ethnic federalism in Ethiopia and points out the current ruling party of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has not taken appropriate measures to defuse ethnic tensions in the country.
But Ethiopia's problem is, firstly, the central government does not want to relinquish any kind of roles to devolved subnational units, the ethno-federal states, the subnational units. But secondly, those very subnational units do not want to be part of Ethiopia, and they want to break away and form their own countries. And we know whenever that happens, you're going to create a war because the central government's going to do all it can to keep the country together. So I think this is part of the reason why ethno-federalism has not worked in Ethiopia.
Another reason Monda gives for ethnic federalism not succeeding in Ethiopia has to do with democracy.
The other reason ethno-federalism has not worked in Ethiopia is because Ethiopia doesn't have a history of democracy. Remember, there were many centuries under a monarchy. The king, the emperor, Haile Selassie, was overthrown in the 70s, and then you had a very brutal Marxist-Leninist dictatorship under Mengistu. And then after that, the country went through a really brutal civil war. So the legacy of democracy and development in institutions has just not been there. And I think this is another reason why ethno-federalism is really becoming a challenge to implement in Ethiopia.
Monda says there are success stories regarding ethnic federalism around the globe. He mentions Switzerland, a small country in the center of Europe known for its political stability. He says Swiss society is multicultural in several aspects, with its citizens speaking German, French, and Italian. Another nation he mentions is Bosnia-Herzegovina. With its loose multinational federation, he says, the country's Serbs, Croats, and Bosnian Muslims have managed to rebuild after a war in the 1990s, although some tensions still remain. Human Rights Watch, HRW, says Ethiopian forces have committed widespread attacks amounting to war crimes against medical professionals, patients, and health facilities in the conflict-torn Amhara region. The northern region was under a state of emergency until last month after fighting erupted there between federal forces and the Fano self-defense militia in August 2023. The French news agency AFP says HRW's page report today is based on interviews with 58 people, including victims and witnesses. HRW says the study documents attacks by federal forces and pro-government militia. The rights group says federal forces have obstructed access to medical facilities, wrongfully arresting patients on mere suspicion of being affiliated with the Fano militia. HRW says international humanitarian law calls for special protections to health facilities, medical professionals, patients, and ambulances. Nigeria and Cameroon say they would no longer seek a court ruling demarcating their disputed border. Officials of both countries say they will not ask for an interpretation of an earlier court decision that gave the oil-rich Bakassa Peninsula to Cameroon after several years of disagreement between the two neighbors. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon and Nigeria said Thursday joint delegations from the two countries would take field trips to validate a demarcation plan along the border and put an end to long-standing territorial disputes. The states share about 2,100 kilometers of border from Lake Chad in the north of the Gulf of Guinea to the Atlantic Ocean coast, where the West and Central African nations meet. Leonardo Santos Simao is the chairperson of the Cameroon-Nigeria Mixed Commission set up by the United Nations to solve the country's territorial disputes. He took part in this week's meeting in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, and said he is delighted the two countries have decided to resolve their disputes without long and expensive processes at the International Court of Justice.
The decision not to refer back to International Court of Justice, the interpretation of the ruling of the court about three areas of disagreement between the two countries was formalized. Secondly, was to give mandate to the demarcation subcommittee to go to the field and find on spot the appropriate solutions for the trajectory of the borderline before the end of the year.
Simao said an agreement to peacefully resolve border disputes between Cameroon and Nigeria before the end of 2025 is a milestone to completing an ongoing border demarcation initiative. The two countries agreed to visit disputed territories in Rumsiki and Turu in northern Cameroon and Koche in eastern Nigeria before the end of 2024. Latef Olasunkanmi Fagbemi is Nigeria's justice minister and leader of the West African States delegation to the Cameroon-Nigeria Mixed Commission that met in Yaoundé. He said the countries have agreed to complete an ongoing survey and demarcation of their land boundary within 12 months.
It's a consensus between Cameroon and Nigeria. By the end of 2025, this project should be concluded. He has so admirably and maturely handled the situation in such a way that there is hardly any dissent. We are satisfied with the outcome of the two-day meeting, and we are hopeful that there is light at the end of the tunnel.
Cameroon and Nigeria say the border demarcation was slowed by Boko Haram terrorism affecting both countries. They say Boko Haram firepower is drastically reduced now and the demarcation can continue. The two states say they will forget their existing differences over the precise location of the border in about 30 villages. The Cameroon-Nigeria Mixed Commission was established in 2002 at the request of President Paul Biya of Cameroon and the then Nigerian leader Olusegun Obasanjo to facilitate the implementation of an October 10, 2002 International Court of Justice ruling that ceded Bakassi, the oil-rich border peninsula, to Cameroon. Nigeria initially rejected the verdict with its Senate, arguing that the ruling, based on a colonial-era agreement, was unfair and should be appealed. But Nigerian officials said the verdict should be respected. The sixth extraordinary session of the Cameroon-Nigeria Mixed Commission in Yaoundé, June 26 to 27, said its decisions will be submitted to President Bola Tinubu of Nigeria and Biya of Cameroon. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America, and for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. For more than 2 weeks, thousands of young Kenyans have been protesting in communities across the country. They originally took to the streets to oppose legislation before Parliament that would have raised taxes sharply on some key consumer goods. Last week, the protests turned violent when demonstrators broke into Parliament and set it on fire. Police fired guns and other weapons at the crowds, and around 40 people died. Although President William Ruto said he would not sign the finance legislation and that it would be withdrawn, the protests have continued with participants demanding that Ruto step down. Young Kenyans living overseas have been watching the protests, which are dominated by people in their 20s, the so-called Generation Z. VOA journalist Brian Itava spoke with two Gen Z Kenyans living abroad. Moses Kamu lives in Ireland.
I would say we are not happy with this Ruto government. I think that is the mechanism that is fueling the youth's braveness, because most of youth are not, they are not happy with the current president and his team. And because of the rise of cost of living, and there's so many jobless youths in Kenya at the moment, and I believe they have that energy, and because of everything has gone up, so they have that energy and they feel like they are being robbed, you know, paying for everything when the politicians are enjoying good luxury life.
Kevin Wanyoni, who lives in Belgium, also backs the protesters and says the finance bill Parliament approved was unworkable.
People are suffering. There was a previous tax bill default in 2013. On top of that, there is this bill. How will people manage it? It's unbearable. Companies will run away from Kenya because of the taxes. Joblessness will increase because companies will have gone to other countries. Tourism will decrease. If you increase the taxes, it will be unbearable for the common mwananchi. Since this government got into power, it has been worse day by day. You can see the corruption that is in this government. The corruption is at a higher level than it was in the back days. This is more than the colonial days. It's the modern colonialism, which is done by our own politicians.
Kenyan police say they have arrested more than 270 people masquerading as protesters who are suspected of going on a criminal rampage during the demonstrations yesterday. The Directorate of Criminal Investigation said in a post on X that 204 suspects were arrested in the capital, Nairobi, and 68 more were arrested in other areas of the country. Human rights sources say 39 people have been killed and 361 injured in 2 weeks of demonstrations. New protests are scheduled for Thursday and Sunday. In our series dedicated to the international diaspora, we feature Ludovic Baron, a 27-year-old Frenchman who settled in Senegal a little over a year ago and has mastered the Wolof language to the point where his Wolof learning videos are going viral on the internet. Alison Fernandez has the story.
Ludovic Baron, a 27-year-old Frenchman, has only been living in Senegal for a year, but he speaks Wolof fluently.
Salam alaikum. Nangadef.
Hello, yes, how are you? Is everything okay? Do you have curdled milk?
Ludovic's neighbors in the Wakam district of Dakar are pleasantly surprised, like this seller of curd milk.
It is surprising to see a Frenchman speak Wolof fluently because most people who come from France here only speak French. He worked really hard to learn quickly. If he left France to come here, it's because he's interested in our language.
It helps with your adaptation. It helps you negotiate prices too. To discover the people, their culture, have good times. If I only spoke French, I couldn't meet people in the same way.
De la même manière, en fait.
In Senegal, 80% of the population, the vast majority, speaks Wolof. Ludovic Baron recognized that the Senegalese people were excited to see a Frenchman speak fluently to them in their language, and so acquiring proficiency in Wolof would facilitate building relationships and effective communication with them. But he did not find enough online resources to learn Wolof. So Ludovic decided to launch his own YouTube channel, Apprendre le Wolof. Now he makes short, humorous videos, always with two subtitles, like this one made during the last Africa Cup of Nations. Today, on the roof of his house, he's recording a video with his friend, Babacar Ndaw, a student and Wolof language enthusiast. Today's theme, colors.
Connaissez-vous le nom des couleurs?
Un Wolof.
Noir.
Nul.
Beige.
Khal.
Ok, merci Babacar. Djerjef.
Nous, ce qu'on essaie de faire, c'est de permettre aux Sénégalais de parler un Wolof pur. Un Dakarois peut parler dans une phrase où il y aura un mot arabe, un mot anglais, un mot français et un mot Wolof.
We try to bring what is profound and allow people from Dakar to take ownership of it.
The videos are very popular and widely shared in different countries around the world, notably in France, where they are followed by many French people of Senegalese origin.
I often get this feedback. The fact that seeing a white person, déjà, ils ressentent un peu la gêne, un peu la honte. Ils se disent, ah, lui, ce blanc-là, il connaît ma langue, la langue de mes parents, alors que moi, je ne la connais pas. Mais ensuite, après la honte, vient la motivation. En fait, ça les motive à apprendre la langue. Ils se disent que si quelqu'un l'a fait à partir de zéro, alors moi aussi, je peux le faire.
Est-ce que vous connaissez ces mots?
Un Wolof.
Le marché.
Diaba.
La voiture.
Damarbi.
Les toilettes.
Between TikTok, YouTube and Instagram platforms, Ludovic already has more than 600,000 followers on his Apprendre le Wolof account, and the number keeps growing. Alison Fernandez, VOA News, Dakar.
An attack blamed on militants killed more than 20 civilians in central Mali. An official from the Provisional Authority told the French news agency, AFP, that at least 21 civilians, about half of them young people, were killed in the village of Djigoubombo, several dozen kilometers from the town of Bandiagara. A youth representative said the three-hour attack began before nightfall on Monday. Mali has since 2012 been ravaged by factions affiliated to the Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State group, as well as by self-declared self-defense forces and bandits.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1. Then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Al Santos, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.